everybody, and welcome to episode number 4 of the Poverty Fighters Podcast. My name is Antonio Aguilar, and I am the Training and Development Coordinator at Fresno EOC. In today's episode, we'll be doing things just a little bit differently. If you were able to listen to episode number 3, you heard my interview with our Manager of Equity and Inclusion, Kevin Williams. He'll actually be hosting today's episode in a new series that we are calling the Equity Series, where Kevin will be touching on topics surrounding diversity, equity, inclusion, and other social causes. So sit back and enjoy episode number 4. Here is Kevin Williams.
Hello, everybody. This is my name is Kevin Williams. I'm the Manager of Equity and Inclusion for Fresno EOC. Thank you for joining this edition of the Poverty Fighters podcast. This is actually part of a series called the Equity Series that we've started. We are starting today, particularly because it is the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia. And in that spirit, we have a very, very special guest today. I will let him introduce himself, themselves. And I'm really excited about this guest. Just knowledge about queer identity, queer spaces, body positivity in many, many different ways. And so with no further ado, I will open the floor to my guest, none other than Matt Joseph Diaz. Matt, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I like to think that every day is International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia and Biphobia, but, you know, in a perfect world. Yes. Yeah, so just for context, in case anybody doesn't know who I am, well, first of all, Kevin and I are longtime friends, siblings in the struggle from Brooklyn-born people that lived in Minnesota for a long time. But yes, I am a public speaker and social media advocate on everything related to queer, non-binary, racial inequality, like you name it. If it's an important social cause, I like to believe that I am a supporter and also probably a member of those communities. I myself am a Puerto Rican non-binary person, he, they pronouns. And all of this stuff is deeply important to me. And especially lately, I think that I have been spending a lot of time thinking not only about what queerness means, but the ways in which we try to define it and how that can affect us both positively and negatively. So being able to come here and have that conversation is really, really exciting for me today.
That is awesome. And exactly why we wanted to have you on the podcast. I think you even started out with something that was really powerful, like how are we defining queer? Right. And one of the things that you know about me, and I think people have begun to learn, is that like I'm very, very big on definition and using words specifically. Right. And so even when I say queer, I think about like, well, queer is a comparison to something else, and what are we comparing it to? And so then what are we saying is the norm when we say queer? Like all those things are kind of running through my head. So I'm really glad you said that.
Yeah, I think especially part of why this has been popping up a lot lately is I've been writing a lot of pieces just kind of for myself to get back in the mood, like back in the swing of things for writing generally, but you know, for public speaking opportunities that are hopefully coming in the near future. And I think it's very important to provide context when you are, you know, introducing yourself when you're going to be speaking about a topic like this. So lately I've been thinking about queer as an umbrella term, right? It's just for the sake of convenience that we use it because we don't have a lot of time to get into everything. I consider myself someone who's pansexual, but recently I was thinking about the fact that like, what that means to me specifically is so different than what it might mean to someone else who either is or is not pansexual. I went by bisexual for a long time and it just really did, it just reached a point where it stopped feeling right. And I think that a lot of people, when we're trying to find these terms to best identify ourselves, what we're trying to do is to communicate our, like who we are to the outside world. Mm. And I think that in doing that, there are times where we tend to get too caught up in what the actual concrete definition is. And we lose sight of the fact that those labels are there for our convenience. They're there for us to be able to express the people that we are. And it's not the opposite. It's not the other way around. Mm-hmm. I think when people worry that they're not using the correct terms for themselves, what they don't realize is that you define what those terms mean. And also those terms can always be changing. And there isn't shame in that. I think especially because people who are queer oftentimes really discover who they are later in their life. it feels like you need to get a grasp of your identity, like right here, right now, in order to be able to affect positive change. But just like with everything else, people are constantly growing and changing. And so it's not incorrect of you to have terms that you change when you're trying to identify yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that. As you were saying that, and I'll jump to my first question, because you actually segued really nicely into that. It makes me think about how we're expecting people to have this identity pin, like by the time they're like 12, 13 years old.
Yeah.
You don't even know, you haven't even hit puberty yet. You don't know what, you know, your career, you don't even, you know, what you're going to major in, but you're supposed to have this really, really solid understanding of what your identity is in terms of being a person and sexually.
Yeah.
When, you know, you're 12 years old, what are you even thinking about that at that point yet?
Yeah.
And secondly, I think about how we've just become accustomed to things changing, but then when it comes to particular groups of people, it's a problem. Like we've said Puff Daddy, Diddy, P Diddy, Puffy, Puff, P Diddy again, Puffy again, and we're all just like, okay, he changed it. Okay, he changed
right.
it. So, you know, so it's just interesting how we are comfortable with that, but then in other sex, you know, it's this challenge.
Yeah, Snoop Dogg can become Snoop Lion for a while, but if I decide that I want a different pronoun, it's a whole thing, right? Yeah. I think that, like, it's incredibly interesting to me because just for like some personal history, this is all stuff that I've like spoken about publicly before. I'm 28 currently. I didn't know that I was queer until I was 22 years old because I happened to meet somebody who like I found myself being attracted to, and just kind of in the moment, like even though I was so taken aback by it, there was this moment where everything sort of fell into place and it felt like suddenly I was seeing myself for the first time. And and that's also the case with my non-binary identity. I mean, I was 25 years old watching Steven Universe on my old bad iPad in my room. And suddenly I see Stevani for the first time, who, you know, you and I both love Steven Universe, but if anyone who's listening to this doesn't know, Stevani is specifically an intersex character who is like specifically a fusion of a boy and a girl and uses non-binary pronouns. And especially because that character is also non-white, and non-white representation is so limited when it comes to like gender expression. It was the first time I felt like I'd ever seen someone that looked like me. And that was the moment that I knew that like I wasn't a cisgendered person, and I was 25 years old. I mean, at that point I had already worked several jobs, gotten out of college, moved halfway across the country, and I was still figuring myself out. And I still, like, to this day am. I think that one of the beautiful things about like queer identity and gender expression is the fact that we're not limited to like just falling one thing into place and then sticking with that our entire lives. I mean, I know queer people that have considered themselves to be like strictly homosexual for a long time, and they meet someone who's non-binary, or they meet someone who's of the opposite sex that they find themselves attracted to, and suddenly it's not as cut and dry as you thought. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a reason it's a spectrum and right. not just a bunch of clearly defined lines.
Right. Thank you. That was really powerful. And you kind of answered this question a little bit, but it's kind of a two-part, and it was to speak a little bit about your journey in recognizing your identity, and then separately, your journey in accepting your identity. And because I think that's definitely something that is a challenge, is that particularly when you're in a society that demands this very, very binary identity.
Oh, yeah.
How do you begin to, I guess, unpack those things that have made you respond in this binary way when you're feeling like this doesn't fit?
Yeah, I think that like if we're talking from more of a sort of internalized like dealing with your own internalized homophobia, your own internalized like transphobia, which just I feel like people who aren't gender nonconforming just kind of have, because everyone like that's just how kind of privilege works.
Right.
I think, and especially, you know, coming from a non-white community where like a lot of non-white communities have a lot of problems when it comes to homophobia or when it comes to gender identity. And I think a lot of that is a survival tactic, right? You and I have talked about this privately before, how it has to do with the way that we perceive masculinity as toughness, and it has to do with the way that we need quote unquote toughness in order to get by in the hood. You know what I mean?
Right.
So being someone who I mean, first of all, I think that I needed to leave New York City and move to Minnesota before I was capable of coming to terms with my own gender identity, because I think that I just had so much tied to like my community there and the ways that, you know, growing up in the 90s in Brooklyn in like in Flatbush, like I didn't really feel safe enough to think about myself in those ways. And, you know, Minneapolis has its own share of problems when it comes to that. But I being here was when I really got to make like queer and gender nonconforming friends. And it's kind of like in the Marvel Cinematic Universe where there's just kind of like a couple of heroes and then suddenly they just keep popping up all over the place. Like, oh, wait, why are all my friends non-binary? And why are all my friends queer? Oh, it's because I actually fit into those identities. And so I attract those like-minded people. But I think that it's so funny because my coming to terms with my queerness and coming to terms with my gender identity were both such different experiences. Because when I came to terms with my queerness at like the age of 22, I had so much that I had to get over. I had so much like not only is it, oh, I'm attracted to more genders than I thought I was, but it's also, wait, if I didn't know this about myself for the first 22 years of my life, then who am I? Like, how have I not known this part of myself? And then there's the aspects of needing to come to terms with the fact that there is a lot of stigma about bisexual men specifically. And that I had to like make this grand reveal to all the people I cared about because I wanted them to know who I was. And then by the time, like 3 or 4 years later, when I realized that I was non-binary, I had done all this already. And also being a non-white person, being a relatively poor person and being a queer person, I was just kind of adding another card to the deck of marginalized identities. So it was just kind of easier to be... I had reached a point then when I was like, okay, I know who I am and I'm like discovering this part of myself. And I, you know, obviously, you know, I live with some non-binary people. I have a lot of non-binary friends and loved ones and everyone talks about it differently. And I think that they're like, you meet people who are non-binary and have never been cisgender. And I think of myself as someone who graduated from being cisgender, like, like I was a man for like 24, 25 years. And then I was like, okay, we had a good time here. I'm putting in my 2 weeks. Like I'm going to get out of here while things are still okay. And then I just sort of became this other aspect of myself. And, you know, and it feels incredible to just know who you are in that way. And also to allow yourself the freedom to make those changes when they become parts of you, you know?
Right. Absolutely. That was awesome. Thank you. Yeah. And in that vein, because you talked about those multiple layers of oppressive identities.
Yes.
How do you experience, and this is a loaded question, right?
Yeah, so, they all are though. I mean, this is what we're here for, right? Let's do it.
True. How does intersectionality impact the way that you navigate navigate space, not only just as a person that identifies as queer in queer spaces, but also in cis straight spaces as well.
Well, yeah, it's so interesting because I think I've reached a point, and you know this about me, but the listeners might not. I've reached a point where my sort of ideology is to demand to be seen. Like Matt Diaz walks into a room and everyone's gonna know who Matt Diaz is. And and just visually, like from a volume standpoint, everything about it. And I think part of the reason why is because you need to carve out those spaces for yourself, especially as a like queer, non-binary brown person, if you want to have those spaces. Right? There are so few spaces that are made for us that we have to like craft them in the spaces that we already have. This feels related to one of the things I talk about with the body positive movement all the time, which is the reason why I stopped doing a lot of the like writing pieces that I did and stopped engaging with a lot of the popular discourse about body image that I did is because we're at a point right now where these things are starting to be accepted, but only as long as they remain palatable to those who are uncomfortable with them. So we can have like, body positivity in the mainstream, we can have plus size people that are in advertising, but it still has to be like conventionally attractive, cisgendered white people, usually fembody people. And that like that feeling just so greatly makes you want to rip your hair out when you're trying to like do the work, but no one is looking at it because it doesn't seem as like, even though we're supposed to be in this space where we're talking about things that are outside the norm, we still have to dilute it as much as possible in order to allow it to be introduced. It's the same reason why, you know, a lot of the times when you get queer characters or when you get trans characters, if it's not a specifically queer or trans form of media, it is stereotypes, it is very clearly defined lines. You're not really going to get a like plus-sized brown gender non-conforming pansexual person. You might get a like straight gay person, a cis gay person, or a like white bisexual person. But because we still need to like, because we're still in a point where we're trying to claw our ways into the mainstream in terms of like coverage and pop culture, we have to like demand to be here, because only by normalizing the fact that we exist and that we're here, like that's the only way that we're actually going to get anything done. I think that like, and I've written about this before, but I always think about the fact that a lot of things about my life would have been easier if I had felt safe enough to discover these parts of myself at a younger age. And so that's why I find it so important to be the representation that you wish that you had when you were young. I mean, you know this, everything about you is that like,
yes.
I know that you basically live your life like wanting to go back in time and show little 10-year-old Kevin Williams like what you're capable of accomplishing. And like, I think it's especially important for people of all marginalized identities to be that, you know?
Awesome. Thank you. And I guess the follow-up to then, right, is what does allyship look like? And I think one of the things that is often a conversation that I have with people is you know, people saying that I'm an ally, and my conversation to them is always, well, you don't get to choose if you're an ally. The people that you are supporting get to decide whether your allyship is helpful. And so, you know, I think that a lot of times, especially when you're coming into spaces that are not, that don't, you know, match your identity, you can make, again, you make assumptions about what people need. You make assumptions about what, you know, what they're capable of doing and what allyship looks like. And that may not be it. And so sometimes I ask, like, have you ever asked somebody like what they need? and so rather than dictate to them and tell them what they need. I think this is a good opportunity. Again, there's no identity that is that's a monolith. Not everybody in any identity is the same. But I think this would be an example for, I think, listeners to follow. Like, what is something that, what are the things that you would identify as allyship, and what does that look like?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I love like what you said about how you don't get to decide that you're an ally is like the truest thing I've ever heard, because any person who's ever told me that they're an ally, I step back and I look at them and I'm like, are you an ally or do you really like Drag Race? Like,
wow. Yeah.
That's how it feels. I mean, I've literally had, you know, I haven't been to a bar in over a year and a half, but I literally have memories of being in a bar in uptown Minneapolis. And it's like the summertime, it's the middle of the day. And I'm standing there minding my own business, trying to get a beer, wearing a crop top. And some like young, well-meaning white woman comes up to me and starts telling me about how she just learned what all the colors in the LGBT flag represent. And it's like, okay, I don't care about that. Like, I understand that you're trying to show me that this is a safe place for me, but like, I don't know what the colors in the flag mean. I just need somebody who's here, like actually giving, like actually doing the work. Like, that's what's really important. First and foremost, I mean, I feel like it's probably not polite to say, but like, causes always need money. Like the way that you prove that you're an ally, if you have the means to, is by opening up that checkbook and like signing the check to get money and resources to the people that need them. Because, you know, good vibes can only do so much if people are actually starving and don't have the resources necessary to enact change. Right. And I just think that like we get so caught up on, you know, solidarity as a concept on like black squares on Instagram And in reality, we don't need you to be silent. We need you to be vocal and calling out the people in your life who you know, like calling out the people in your life who you are just allowing to say like things that are racist or homophobic or hurtful because it's too much work to correct them on that. That's what allyship looks like. Allyship isn't about like, I mean, it is about showing support for the queer people in your life that you care about, but it isn't about like proving to everyone just how woke you are for the sake of not being canceled someday. Yeah. It's about actually doing the work necessary because you understand that these marginalized communities are suffering. And in order to do that, like, silence isn't the answer. Being as loud as possible because you're using the privilege that you have as a white person or as a cis person or as a straight person in order to actually get resources for those in need is what allyship is. You should be magnifying the voices of the people in your life who are these marginalized people who are trying to say something. You should be donating to like mutual aid. And and what's I feel is very important right now, especially like, you know, I'm here in Minneapolis. There's been a lot of protests in the last year ever since everything that happened with George Floyd. And it's been so interesting because I have helped like, I've helped spread information about places where people can donate to like mutual aid and like direct community aid. And I've gotten so many messages from people who were like, thank you for sharing this because every place that I've heard of that I could donate to has so much money that I don't feel like it's going, like, I don't feel like my $100 is going to get used in a way that actually directly supports people. Like, wasn't it, I think Reclaim the Block had to like start telling people not to keep sending them money because they got so much money immediately following the George Floyd protests. Like just actually doing your research and finding out like, okay, what are the communities that are being affected by this thing specifically near me? In what ways can I give to them directly? So I know that this is being like that these resources are being used. And there are always like, there are always people who need resources. And all of your like positive energy and like putting your pronouns in your bio, it's all good. And it's all, we're all glad that it's here. But in reality, we need you to actually like show up and give and do the work.
There's a phrase that I like to use that, hard work is hard, right? You know, you know, putting up a black square isn't hard. You know, saying, you know, I support this, putting up a nice background picture on your social media page is not hard. You know, and so it's like you have, it's like the weight of the discomfort of the inequity has to be carried, which means that you have to do some things that are going to make you uncomfortable that you're not used to doing in order to make it balanced. And so I, that is something that I think that, societally we really have to think about in terms of like all these different levels of inequity, because whether it be Black Lives Matter, whether it be you know, LGBTQ rights or and causes, you know, even with the things that are happening overseas, we are so quick to put up a sign, very quick to put up a picture, but that the picture doesn't actually change the condition that people are in. And, you know, how much have we as a country become tied to the idea of presenting without doing? Like, we're not really worried about being transphobic or being racist as long as we don't look like we're transphobic or racist.
People don't really think about the fact that you can do harm without intending to, just because you're so like caught up in how the systems already exist. Like, have you ever, this is an analogy that I've used before, but have you ever heard of the issue with like, if you're in public and someone like starts having a seizure and you run to help them and you say, someone call 911, there is a chance, there is a really good chance, and this has happened like a lot of times before, like historically, that no one will call because everyone assumes that everyone already has called.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what you're supposed to do is point to one specific person and tell them to call 911. So, you know, like they know that they have a responsibility mm-hmm. to do this. I feel like that problem on a way larger scale is often what happens in these situations, which is people will share something, like people will share an important infographic to their Instagram story, or they will retweet an article that they haven't read, but has a very like compelling headline that, you know, is for all intents and purposes, well-intended, but in doing so, these people share this information, and in their brain, it's okay, well, I shared this so other people will have access to the information, and that's where the responsibility stops, because somebody else will take care of it. I'm not an activist. I'm not someone who goes out and like does these big things, so I'm sure that someone else will handle it. I've done my part to spread the word, and like that, getting information out there is a really good thing. But first of all, you should always read articles before you share them. You know how I feel about this.
Yes.
and second of all, you have to like, you have to make an effort to actually do the work beyond just spreading visibility. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many people see something if nobody says something.
Right, right. You know, I think as you were saying that, I was just thinking about what we find important. And even when you're talking about the sharing, you know, the woman saying that, you know, she understands what the flag means. I thought about times when people have tried to connect with me and say like, oh, you know, I got this really cool, you know, Jamaican flag, and it was red, green, and gold. And I was like, that's not the colors of the Jamaican flag. Those are the colors of Ethiopia, which you associate with Jamaica because of Rastafarianism and Bob Marley, that is not Jamaica. And so it's just this attempt to connect, but also this very, very big need. And I think this is also one of the difficulties in this concept of people deciding that they're allies, is that the actual work becomes less important than being visible. Like, I want everybody to see that I did this. Right. And that's like, even with social media, if I have my flag up, everybody can see that I support it, even if I'm not doing anything. And so that becomes dangerous because it creates this path of apathy, where as long as I, you know, can put up, you know, a rainbow flag, then I'm not a bad person. Right. Yeah. You know, and, you know, it's sad the conditions still exist. And I, you know, I really, you know, thoughts and prayers that it gets better, but I'm not going to do anything about it.
Yeah. I'm putting good vibes out. That's what really matters. No, I fully agree. I think that especially like you run into this problem where people are especially like leftists, right? People who are generally pro like racial equity, pro trans rights, but are still on the outside, like people who aren't actually marginalized, but want to show support, are so scared of being perceived as racist or being perceived as homophobic that it basically renders them like impossible to talk to sometimes. You run into so many situations where you are saying something as like a marginalized person, and people's reaction, because they are so upset that you calling them out has made them look bad, that they just like fully devolve into being someone you can't communicate with. And I think that that's one of the largest problems, is that if you get mad at me for saying that something that you said was racist, rather than actually trying to listen and do better, then it shows me that you care more about being perceived as racist than you do about being actually racist, because as a white person, you don't get to decide what's racist.
Right, right.
Like if I'm telling you, yo, I think that what you said was kind of messed up, like it seemed like there was some anti Latino sentiment in there, you can't be like, nah, I disagree. Like, that's just not how it works. And, you know, it's so difficult to thread that needle, because like, you know, at some point you gotta say what you gotta say, and it doesn't matter who you upset, because you're fighting for like those like you. But when you tell, like, when you're trying to communicate with someone that they need to like take a breath, open their ears, and actually hear the things that you're saying because you care enough to put the effort in telling them, like when you're doing that and it still doesn't reach them, it is so like, it can feel so heartbreaking and so discouraging to continuing to put that work in, because like at the end of the day, we do a lot of kowtowing ourselves to try and seem palatable when we confront someone on something they did that was homophobic or racist or transphobic, because we don't want them to get their feelings so hurt that they start being that way.
Right. Like, right.
It's hard. It's super hard, but you know, it's part of the sort of assumed labor that comes in being marginalized is that the people, when you tell them that they're being racist, they'll say, oh, well, teach me. It's like, it's not my job to teach you. You want me to teach you? I'm going to Venmo request you $100 and then we can spend like 20 minutes and I'll talk to you about it. But
yeah,
I don't have a job by just existing as a marginalized person to make sure you understand why I deserve to be here.
Right, right. Google it.
Yeah, seriously. Literally, there's like, I know that there's YouTube videos on this subject because I used to make them.
Right. I have this one last question that I had, and then there are some things that I got from some of the LGBTQ Center people here in Fresno.
Awesome.
I think would be great for us to discuss.
I'd love that. Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of the key issues that you believe currently that are impacting the queer community? And I ask that because there's obviously some that are on the forefront, but I think that, again, I think people need to be aware of the different ways that even like there could be things that are just like happening every day that people don't really understand impact the way that you and other people like navigate the world as a person that has a queer identity.
Yeah, I think that like if we're talking about sort of general issues that I feel like are running rampant right now that might not, you know, they aren't making headlines because they're just sort of issues that are persistent with queer identity. For instance, like what a large percentage of like houselessness is a problem when it comes to queer people, because there is just so much like home insecurity that happens, especially with young queer people. And I fully believe that like that is one of the most important things that we can do to try and like quell the numbers of like suicides that happen related to queerness, is because I saw this post going around for a long time where it's like, hey, helping queer people is suicide prevention. Like helping provide security and resources to queer people is suicide prevention. And it's true, because like the suicide rates among queer and gender nonconforming people, especially under the age of like 25, are so astronomical, largely because there is just like, when you're a young person who is queer and doesn't feel like they can come out to the people who are supposed to care about and protect you, it is a devastating and heartbreaking and terrifying thing to have to live with, because you have the options of hiding yourself and hiding who you are from the world until you feel safe enough to come out, or coming out anyway and being able to be yourself, but like having your entire world turned upside down. And I think that along with like the way that gender expression and sexual identity are taught, or better yet, not taught in this country, is truly insane. Like I am someone who is queer, and I didn't know about most of the terms until I was in my mid-20s because of that. Like the New York City public education system did me no favors when it came to explaining like what the concept of gender expression was. And that might have been back in the early 2000s, but like I worked in several schools over the past couple of years, and that has never been a conversation that was even close to being had. We are so worried about, like, there are still these echoes of like moralizing queer identity, where if like, where people who feel like if they teach queerness, if they teach the concept of queerness to a young person, that person may just latch onto it, and that's a bad thing. Like that is such a pervasive issue, because we still, like as a society, we still view queerness as something that is a failure on the part of like how we raised someone. There are sometimes I give myself a stomach ache by going to the comments of articles about like parents who are very supportive of their trans children, and just seeing the people don't write comments on news articles because they feel good about what's going on. People only write comments on news articles because they're angry. And just the amount of time that we spend trying to push the concepts of queerness and gender expression away from children because we're worried of what it could do to their future, when often young queer people are killing themselves now, is the biggest problem that we are currently facing when it comes to the queer identity, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. Because there are so many times when young queer people kill themselves, and it could have been preventable if they just felt as though they were safe to literally just exist. Mm-hmm. And that will never not break my heart. But I think that when it comes to, you know, being someone who is an outspoken queer person on the internet, like, just existing and being who you are and being loud and demanding to be perceived as you are, insisting on your pronouns even when it's hard because you're in a work situation, or standing up and not having to hide yourself because you feel like you won't be accepted, like, that is, in and of itself, an act of rebellion in a world that doesn't want you to exist. Mm-hmm. And doing that is, like, one of the biggest things that we can do for young queer people, because the more of us they see, the safer they know they'll be to be themselves.
Awesome. Thank you. You've actually hit, interestingly, you know, there are some things that you hit in what you're saying that speak to some of the things that are going on here in the Central Valley, which I guess really speaks to just, like, how this is a national issue and not
a universal issue. Yeah. Right,
and not something that is, you know, parked in certain areas.
Yeah.
And also, I just, you know, as I'm getting to that, I also want to touch on something that you said, talking about what can, you know, teaching young people about this do to them. And then maybe that'll make them queer, and that's a fear, which is really interesting to me, because that means that, you know, by comparison, that then also means that being straight is indoctrinating.
Yeah.
Right. Is that so you really understand that, you know, you are indoctrinating your kids to be this way, because the argument against it is that if I expose this to them, they will become XYZ.
Yeah. So, it's so wild, dude. Like, it will never not be weird to me that you were worried that teaching your child that they could be trans will make them trans, because nobody who isn't trans would choose to be trans.
Right.
Like, there's this strange misnomer for some reason that, like, oh, well, this person might choose to be gay. And it's like, no, do you see how we treat gay people in this country? Nobody who wasn't gay would choose to be gay just for fun. Like, right. That's not how it works. What you're doing is showing someone a part of who they are rather than exposing them to a choice they can make.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you for that. So spot on. So one of the, a couple of things that are going on here. So first and foremost, to your point about needing resources and needing them early, one of the reasons why the LGBTQ Resource Center that Fresno EOC has put up is really, really important is because the last one, there was only, the last one was closed in 2017. And wow. So the community here hasn't, you know, the LGBT people in Fresno, the Central Valley, really haven't had that resource center for now, would be 4 years. And so, like, you know, thinking about, like, the access and the support, having that is extremely important. And then also the resource center is really trying to and looking to strengthen access to LGBTQ competency trainings, particularly in school districts. And so I kind of wanted to touch base with you just about, like, how do you feel trainings are effective? I have my own thoughts on it, but I just wanted, from your perspective, like, what are their importance and how valuable are they?
Well, I want to, like, preface all of this by saying the fact that, like, any sort of diversity and inclusivity sort of, like, trainings, anything that we do to standardize and, like, make a system out of showing how important it is to be inclusive to marginalized people in, like, professional and educational settings is deeply important. I do think that it definitely depends on who the organizations are that are doing these trainings, because as someone who exists as a queer person and as a non-binary person in Minneapolis and has worked several jobs in this place, I have been to 3 or 4 different diversity and inclusivity trainings that were all taught by people who were not members of those communities. And I don't vibe with that at all, because it always kind of feels insincere, because you can tell when straight people are talking about queerness, because they talk about it like you talk about a movie you've never seen but have read the Wikipedia summary for. Like, if you want people to care, like if you want people to take what you're saying into account and actually hold it with them, which is what you should be getting from any good like diversity, inclusivity, mm-hmm. or public speaking event, is the conversation. One of my favorite podcasters says that a conversation doesn't end when people stop talking. A conversation ends when people stop thinking about the words that were said.
Mm.
And if you leave a diversity training or an inclusivity training, and the first thing you say is, "Ugh, I'm so glad that's over. Time to go get lunch." Like, that is someone who didn't speak with passion, and that is someone who didn't speak with experience. Because I genuinely believe that you could never talk to someone who was queer about their queerness for a long period of time and why it's important to accept and understand them and not come away thinking about it still. And, you know, I'm sure that the LGBT Resource Center will have plenty of people that are queer to help lead these. But it has been, like, up until this point, largely because we are still so bad as a society at normalizing queerness. Every time I've ever dealt with an inclusion or inclusivity training, it has been with people who weren't of those identities, and that is exhausting. Mm. And it's disconcerting. If I am sitting here and I know more about this than the person who's teaching me, then we have a problem, because aside from being someone who lives this, I don't really know anything statistically. And it's so tough, because when you get people, and you know, this is also a problem systemically with how we don't give queer and trans people enough jobs, right? Mm-hmm. But when you have someone who is a member of those organizations, like I led a workshop for the Trans Equity Summit last year here in Minneapolis. It was virtual, but it was basic for the Minneapolis local government. Mm-hmm. And just talking to those people, like, not even in the panels, but just the way they talk about their panels, there is a passion there, because they so clearly want to help others understand.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a natural sort of magic that happens when you are someone of these marginalized identities, and you get an opportunity to stand there and to try and get other people to understand where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's exhausting, often it's exhausting, but what it never is insincere or like something that just washes off your back. It is always something that you hold with you. And if we could get a standardized system of queer, gender nonconforming or brown folks into these organizations to get them to go out and tell people, like, hey, here's why you shouldn't be racist. Like, here's why homophobia is so much deeper ingrained in our society than you understand. And this is why it's toxic. And here's the work you need to do. Like, there is so much we could do with just the resources to be able to go out and do that. Like, every generation gets more and more like radicalized, and every generation gets more and more liberal in a very good way, because you can't stop progress. Like, you can hold it for a while, mm-hmm. but the people will only grow to be more accepting of queer and non-binary and mm-hmm. non-white folks over time, because there are just more and more of us coming each day. And that's an incredible thing. Like, I'm only 28, but Gen Z is out here, like, at the age of 16, just like knowing and understanding terms and about gender identity that I had no idea about at that age. Mm-hmm. And that is an amazing thing, but we can never just like bet on that. We have to be out here actively doing the work all the time, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think about that in terms of like some of the training that I've done.
Oh, I know.
And what's so interesting to me is that I often do wonder how somebody who doesn't have the identity does those trainings, specifically because so much of, and this is the way that I do trainings, right, is that it's important because this is something that is a very, very emotional thing. And it's very, very, you can talk facts, but it's really important to engage people on an emotional level, right? How can you speak from that emotional level on something you haven't experienced?
Yeah, and I have asked that question in trainings before, and it has not gone well for me. But, you know, I think generally, like, people want, I think a lot of the times it has to do with the fact that people are often just kind of put in the position to have to lead those trainings without it being the initial thing that they started working there to do. But it's wild to me because I could not understand how you could stand there and feel capable of having this discussion, especially when there are people of these identities that are like there listening to you. Yeah, I don't understand it, but I'm hoping that it becomes a less and less frequent thing.
yeah, for sure. And to that point, also talking about just like you touched on this as well, housing. That is an extremely big issue here in the Central Valley, and not just specifically for the LGBTQ community. Just generally, like, housing is continuing, and that's, you know, the same in Minneapolis.
Yeah,
definitely the same in New York. Absolutely the same, you know, in the Bay and in Los Angeles and all these different places across the country. But, you know, one of the things that I think is challenging is that you know, a lot of the shelters and those housing services are really based in these organizations that are you know, religion-based.
Yeah.
And so then you have the challenge of these spaces not being safe for LGBTQ people because of those, because it's faith-based and their faith is directing them that they have to hold these standards and hold these positions that limit the accessibility for housing, you know, for trans people,
LGBTQ trans people. It is truly one of the most sort of difficult underlying things that you deal with when you deal with like nonprofit organizations from time to time. Like back when I was doing a lot of public speaking events, I would go through and check every organization that I was like, that would be a part of the event that I was at to make sure that like, oh, well, you know, even though I'm talking about body positivity, I'm not going to go do an event with this organization because I know they're founded in some like Christian fundamentalist beliefs that have a lot of problems with a lot of aspects of my identity. So I don't want anything to do with them. Like, it's incredibly tough. And for the most part, like the good thing is that the sort of march of time has sanded down a lot of those edges for a lot of organizations. You know, I think that like you run into a lot of situations where people are religious, but they are a sort of like compassionate religious that still allows them to hold space in their heart for queer and non-binary people. And it's like, that's great personally, but y'all need to work on this systemically, because systemically your religion still isn't super cool with like anything I got going on.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's hard because you can run into situations where people who are queer or non-binary or trans, you know, are without a home and they can't even go to a lot of the shelters that are available in their area because they're rooted in like fundamentalist religious beliefs. And it is yet another pitfall that they have to navigate in order to try and find a safe space to be. And so I think that like having organizations that are directly focused on like housing trans and queer people are so important, because what you need more than anything is a beacon for people to look to. Like, you don't need a place, you don't just need a place where you can go and hopefully you'll be safe. You need a place that you know is created for you to be safe.
Right. Absolutely. And it's interesting because as you were talking about that, I remember there's so many conversations I've had between the difference between religion and faith.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also just thinking about the ways in which, you know, we can, you know, religion can be used in a way to continue acts of oppression.
Fully, yeah.
You know, and so some conversations that I've had, because I grew up as going to church, and I grew up and my dad was a missionary. You know, there's one scripture that always sticks out to me when like talking with people about you know, queer identity, is particularly trans identity, right? It's scripture is as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And that is so, it's so key to me, because it's like you spend so much time, right, saying this is not who you are. And it's like, well, no, even the scripture says like, this is who they are in their heart. And so even so, you know, if your thought process is, I'm going to, for lack of a better term, pray this away,
right?
The truth of the matter is that, you know, by telling them to not present who they are, you're still impeding, you're still stopping that from happening.
Yeah.
If your idea is that you have to, like, you're still stopping it from happening. So
it's, for sure.
It's sick, this whole cyclical thing.
Yeah. I think that, like, and you know, for context, I myself am not a religious person. I was raised Catholic, but my parents, once I was 13 and told them I wasn't really feeling it, my dad was just kind of psyched that he didn't have to get up early on Sundays anymore. So my upbringing with religion has been very lax, but I firmly believe that it is not your religion that dictates that you are homophobic. I believe that you are homophobic and you are using your religion as a crutch to justify it. Because at the end of the day, I don't care if you're homophobic because you think queer people are gross, or if you're homophobic because you think that God said that you should be, that impact is still the same. And you using that as an excuse in order to tell me that my existence is invalid is just one of the, like, one of the most simple ways that you can use something higher than yourself in order to validate your own bigotry. It often proves as cowardly to me, because it's like, hey, you know what? If you tell me that you're a homophobe because you think that queer people are disgusting, then I don't get what, first of all, you need to go away. But second of all, I don't agree with you, but at least you're saying that. If you're telling me that you're only homophobic because your religion dictates that you have to be, like, you're just hiding behind that when in reality, it is something that is firmly a part of you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the very least, the first guy, even though he was direct about it, like, had an idea that he was standing behind.
Yeah.
And that's something I respect more, even though I don't respect either of you specifically.
Right. Well, that's really interesting too, because we see that in, like, some of the challenges that I've kind of experienced in coming to Fresno, which has a larger rural community. And you know, that some people see that as like a detriment to the liberal politic.
Right.
When, you know, I would really argue that if you look at the outcomes, the outcomes in a place like Minneapolis, which is, you know, technically a blue state, right? The outcomes for black and brown people, and you know, particularly black and brown people that identify as queer, are significantly worse. You know, and so it's like, part of that is the fact that you have to have the conversation. And to your point that you made earlier about, like, people who are more interested in not wanting to seem racist than not be racist, then that means that those conversations don't happen. Yeah. And not only do those conversations don't happen, but it's harder to have them because people are refusing to engage at all.
Fully. Yeah. I mean, I have gotten so many DMs on Instagram when I have posted stories about the fact that there are things that you don't realize might be racist, and how you have to, like, take that into account and, like, live with that and think about that and work with that. Mm-hmm. I've gotten so many messages that begin with the phrase, like, I'm not a racist because of this. And it's like, all right, I'm not reading this anymore, because like, not listening to a non-white person who is explaining racism to you is in and of itself a racist action.
Right.
And it is just about, it's so often about, like, okay, how abrasive can I be with this person who did something that was super racist without them getting so upset that I am pointing out that they're being racist that they stop listening to me altogether.
Right.
And, like, you know that is just, like, the eternal struggle of being a marginalized person in a, like, cis white straight world is just like, okay, I'm going to push a little bit this time, but hopefully I don't get so mad that they call me the F slur and then block me on Twitter. Like,
right.
And sometimes that still happens, and that's fine. I don't want any, like, bigots on my timeline anyway. Get out of here. But, like, at least be polite, because I took the time out of my afternoon when I could be, like, watching anime to instead have an argument with you on the internet about how something you said was incredibly homophobic.
Yes. Absolutely.
Respect my time.
Right. And speaking of, actually, we're almost at time. And so I just wanted to leave the floor open for you. If there's anything in particular that I think that, you know, people should know, we talked about what allyship looks like.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that I would, again, just like to leave the floor open for you to kind of say like, hey, this is something that you need to be aware of. Or, you know, these are the different ways that you can show up and support this movement.
Yeah. There's always more to say, you know?
Yes.
And I'm always ready to have more conversations. So if someone is listening to this and wants to have those conversations, you can just find like Matt Joseph Diaz on all social media platforms. But I want people, if anyone who is like in Minnesota or near Minnesota happens to listen to this, which I'm sure they will, because I'm going to be telling a bunch of people about this, because I'm super psyched about it. Donating to Outfront Minnesota, which is a like queer positive and like queer supporting nonprofit that personally I know, like I know people who are involved there and who work incredibly hard every day in order to make that place as helpful and give as much direct action as possible. I think that the only thing that I could really tell people is if people want to take the effort to talk to you, make the effort to listen. Because there is nobody, I would never talk to someone about the way that their homophobia or their transphobia or the way that their racism hurt my feelings if I didn't care about them enough to want to put that effort in. Like, right. I'm not around here messaging people about how something they said was super racist because I have infinite free time. Like, when I find somebody who is doing something hurtful, even if it's unintentional, I either block them or unfollow them because they don't matter to me, or I make the effort to reach out.
Right.
And every marginalized person is like that. We don't reach out because we have like an infinite amount of time and wisdom to spare. Like, I got bills I have to pay. If I'm messaging you and trying to talk to you about something that's happening, it's because you matter enough to me for me to put that effort in. And that in and of itself should be enough for you to want to listen. Like, at the end of the day, we're all just people who are trying to communicate with each other. And there are always going to be missteps and mistakes when it comes to that. But like, we're all just out here, and make the effort to listen and understand that it doesn't make you a bad person because you might have slipped up and said or done something wrong. Also, if someone corrects you on their pronouns, this is just like a little thing, but I feel like it's always super important. If somebody corrects you on their pronouns, don't like freak out about how sorry you are about it, because it's not that big a deal. We just need to have that communication. Like, if I tell you my pronouns are they, them, and you accidentally use him, and I'm like, hey, it's they, them. Don't be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, I'm just like, I'm really trying. It's like, yo, calm down. It's fine. Let's just keep having brunch. I'm just like, I just want to make sure you know, like, cause I misgender myself all the time by accident. Cause I got like 25 years of being a he, him.
Right.
And so it's just so important to like, take a breath, try to remember it, but don't freak out, because that is one of the most infuriating things about being gender nonconforming and dealing with cis people.
Absolutely. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. Glad to be here, man.
Yeah. And I'm sure that, people will be listening and engaged, and I couldn't have thought of a more fitting or better guest for this day. So thank you all. And if you want to follow Matt on social media, you want to put any tags that you want to use.
No, just at Matt Joseph Diaz on, I'm largely on Instagram. That's where I do a lot of my hemming and hawing about queer identity. So feel free to check me out there.
All right, awesome. Thanks, Matt, and thank you everybody for listening. This has been the Equity Series of the Poverty Fighters podcast. Until next time, talk to you soon.